When high school ended, I drove taxi from 1977 to early 1978. I'd saved up some money, enough to go to Europe. I'd bought a railway pass, and I met up with a friend in Switzerland. Eventually got to Germany. There was a lot of demand for cars in Iran at the time. You could drive down there and get paid to go as far as Tehran. I thought, okay, well, that sounds good. The idea was you could just go from Tehran to Afghanistan and hopscotch over to Thailand, go on a long trip. I ended up hired to drive a car. I was paid a lot of money. I met a couple people at the hostel who were doing the same thing. We became pretty good friends. You know, it was a good time. We had money and cars. We went to Austria, then Yugoslavia, and then Bulgaria, and then we ended up in Turkey. Turkey hadn't quite been fully modernized. It was a bit of an exotic city. Istanbul had a lot of open markets, very, very different from what I had ever seen before. The roads from Istanbul were pretty good. Then when we got to Ankara, the roads basically disappeared. It was more like driving down a wide gravel track. Then once we got to Iran, you know, the roads were top of the line roads. So then we got down to Tehran. We got paid. The cars went off on their way somewhere else. Driving through borders in Europe at the time was kind of a headache. This was still Iron Curtain. You know, they're actually pretty fortified. The lead car was sort of like a fixer. He would take care of everything. We waited around in Tehran for the passports to come back. We had a good time in Tehran. In 1978, there were actually tourists in Iran. There was a lot of Americans living there. Iran had fallen into line with U.S. values at the time with the Shah. Still a lot of traditional people dressed in the old ways, like with the, you know, the coverings and the hijabs. But almost every single young person was wearing jeans. And there's discotheques, restaurants and nightclubs, people driving fancy cars. It was a pretty advanced city. The passports came back a few days later, and they had removed a certain import or excise stamp in the passport. You could sort of see something had been removed. Didn't really think too much of it. I decided I'm going to go back to Greece. One of the guys who had driven down with, he was actually going back to Europe too. So him and I decided we'll take the train back. We left Tehran in the morning and we got up to the border pretty late at night. It was dark. The political climate had started to change. That was the very beginning of a revolution. At the time, I didn't really notice it. It was light when the customs authorities came on board the train to inspect all the passports. When they got to the two of us, they took our passports. They saw that they had been altered, and so we were removed from the train. There's a little border post full of soldiers and police. No one wanted us there, but they couldn't get rid of us. As soon as we ended up in someone's hands, we got shoved into someone else's very fast. We just thought, it'll resolve itself. We just got to meet the right person, someone who had taken money or something. Then suddenly the train left, and then we realized we weren't getting on the next train. And that's when it dawned, oh no, this is going to be a giant headache. The police, actually, they were pretty friendly. We were playing table tennis with them, and they want to know where you're from, and they want to practice their English. They didn't lock us up. They weren't worried we were going to escape. There's the Turkish border on one side of the pass, 50 miles of mountains on the other. Like, there was nowhere to go. We got sent back to the city of Tabriz. Pretty long ride. Two officers accompanied us. They were not foreboding or mean or dark. We were all having a good time chatting and laughing. Still probably thought we could talk our way out of it. And then they're kind of like, okay, we're here. We pulled up in front of the Justice Department. It was a bureaucratic all day long, just, you know, office, 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 talking to various military and police officials. That night, we were put in the local lockup. About 8 at night, it was pretty quiet. It was Steve and I and like two or three other people. But and through the night, every hour or two, more people would be added to it. People were in there screaming and yelling. It was a sleepless night. It just was so noisy and so jam-packed. The situation started to become a little more clear then. It seems that whoever was supposed to smooth things over, it didn't happen. We just went from office to office to office. And there's all these gigantic teetering stacks of paper files everywhere. When I saw that, I thought, oh man, what's the backlog? We don't have a chance. They started telling us, okay, you smuggled these cars. Now you're gonna have to go to jail. We got sent to the Tabriz prison,
the big one.
The first day or two was just endless talking to people. One interview after another, after another, after another. They just said, you're gonna be here for a while. All our stuff that we had was taken away and we were given prison uniforms. You know, you're starting to think, oh, maybe it's getting serious now. Mike Matrinko, the U.S. consulate in Tabriz, I don't think we'd been there more than a few days before we got in touch with him. He came right down. He was really excited to see what was going on. He was cut from a very different cloth. He was in his early 30s. He had been in the Peace Corps there, so he was pretty connected to the country. We had the private, serious meeting with him. He goes, well, you guys are really in for a good cross-cultural experience. Matrinko seemed to think that we would get the equivalent of a plea bargain with probably a substantial fine. Told us just to wait it out. It shouldn't be too long. The jail itself was pretty bad. They didn't allow books, but he knew some people in the jail, so he made some arrangements. Suddenly we had like 60 books. He put us in line with some lawyers. He got in touch with our parents. He said he'd come by every week or two. Yeah, the day-to-day life was very much the same. We didn't have cells. It was just a big room. It would be like being imprisoned in a 50s high school classroom with beds. Everyone would get their own bread, and that was like for the day. Really good bread. It's kind of like a pizza crust baked in the prison. I think it was 50 grams of butter or goat cheese. And then lunch, two guys would bring a big cauldron of, you could call it a stew, mostly potatoes. Everyone got a big aluminum bowl and a spoon. They went with their bowls and just dipped the bowl in. It had a little walled garden outside. You could actually walk around in circles. A lot of times we didn't have power in the prison. There was nothing to do at all, ever. Where we were kept was where they kept some of the political prisoners. That was actually interesting because they tended to be a little more educated. One of them, he spoke English good enough to converse. He was actually a fairly big leader of Kurdish people. We became pretty good friends with him. We went to him for everything. He knew there was currently a lot of unrest, but he wasn't too plugged into that. They were keeping him pretty much cut off from any outside information. He would get newspapers, but there'd be articles cut out. Slowly but surely, the political climate was turning for the worse. Matrinko would tell us when he visited, and then his visits got fewer and far between. He's going around all day finding out what's going on and then sending cables back to Washington, effectively a spy. Iran was really falling apart at the seams. People that had the means to get out of the country were doing so, and that included a lot of the judges, government leaders. At the very same time, you had the Ayatollah Khomeini telling people in Iran that he was the real leader and to follow his rule, not the Shah. In one of the many demonstrations in Tabriz, the courthouse was burned down. And so that put a huge damper on our hopes of getting anything done. Couldn't go to court. We were just stuck in the prison. There'd be demonstrations and the police would fire back. They were killing like maybe hundreds of people at these big demonstrations. Around Christmas of 78, things started to take a serious turn for the worse. The demonstrators were starting to get armed. They were getting into more like street battles. Khomeini kept up the pressure on the Shah. The Shah kept denying things were happening. The prison was a target of a lot of the demonstrations because there was a lot of political prisoners that the Shah had put in there. There was wild rumors in the prison. We were going to get out. Everybody's getting released. There was Shah and anti-Shah factions in the military. The everyday police and guards tended to be loyal to the Shah, and so was the army and the Air Force to back Khomeini. The Shah was basically hounded out of the country. No one knew what was going to happen. Matrinko didn't know. He just said, we'll wait it out. We'll just see. We thought, oh, great. Khomeini's here and the Shah's gone and maybe some sense of normality will happen because when the whole government is collapsing, the leader of the country that you're imprisoned in is leaving, you know, you're kind of pin your hopes to anything. That's when all hell broke loose. The Air Force split from the Shah officially and would come in and fly very low and at supersonic speeds over the city, which is really terrifying. Suddenly it's right over your head. It sounds like they're dropping bombs. You feel that shockwave from the boom. It sounds like the world is ending. The government was completely falling apart. The Air Force went to war with the Army. It was armed battles around the city. Large mobs of people were roaming around the city too, getting control of all the weapons. Everything was changing every 10 minutes. So we had heard, you know, Air Force back and forth, you know, Khomeini, pro-Khomeini, no Khomeini. There was rumors that the prison was going to be stormed and we would be freed. One day, I started to notice the guards were kind of panicking. A lot of them were changing out of their uniforms into civilian clothes, hiding their weapons. Later that day, a large crowd was gathering and you could hear a lot of tanks, very loud diesel engines, war weapons. We were very unsure what was going to happen. Did they want to let us out or just kill everybody in there? I looked out and I saw two armed soldiers running down, holding weapons the guards just didn't have, and the uniforms were different. We could hear metal doors being rammed with heavy equipment. So suddenly you could hear people really cheering, and it was just a loud, wild scene. The prison started to burn, so it really was time to go. Staying there wasn't an option. Then suddenly there was a lot of shooting. A fire truck had smashed through two very large steel doors, and the doors were wide open. There we were, out of the prison. Matrinko had told us, if you get out for some reason, just come to the consulate. Now, we didn't know where the consulate was, but we ran down the hill into this dry ravine. Across the ravine was a fairly large highway that was crowded with parked cars everywhere. People had stopped just to see what was going on. Scramble down the ravine. It's kind of rocky, sandy, run maybe 50 yards. Now, the going up the other side was trickier. The slope was just right that you couldn't get a good handhold. You hear a lot of gunfire behind you and it started shooting in your direction. We would have been very easy targets trapped there. We've made it this far and now we're sitting ducks. People on the highway were just taking people away from the prison. Crowds were getting in the back of trucks and the trucks were driving away with them. So we got up, me and the guy who I was originally arrested with, we got in a taxi. I told him, you know where the American consulate is? He said, yeah. So he took us there. We get to the consulate. Mike Matrinko comes out. He's like, hey, glad to see you. He wasn't really fazed by the whole thing at all. He didn't really think it was a big deal that we had just escaped this burning, exploding prison under a hail of gunfire. So he goes, come on in. We burned the prison uniforms in case they started doing a roundup. There was a little PX in the consulate. It had a limited amount of clothing. And so we were dressed in a weird assortment of clothes, but we had clothes. It was just a waiting game, but we didn't know what we were waiting for. At that point, life in Tabriz was downright dangerous. The tables had turned very, very fast. Like what was okay 3 weeks ago was not now acceptable at all. Whatever American presence were in Tabriz, they weren't there anymore. They had asked Matrinko to leave the consulate and us behind, but he wouldn't do that. Now that we were out, he was saying, okay, we have plans to go to Tehran. The one catch was there was no way to do it. We were there for 6 days in the consulate. They had a big radio room. And so he would go in there and he was talking to the embassy down in Tehran. It would start out, no, there's no cars. The road is damaged. 10 cities in between are in Air Force hands. So driving was not possible. Then he started to explore. We could have gone over to Turkey. We thought that the full might of the USA was going to airlift us right out of that problem. He goes, we're so far off the radar. It's the weekend in Washington. There's nobody around. They're not even paying attention to what we're doing. There started to be some big demonstrations outside the front gate. Every night there was the whole Death to America protest out in front. So one of the local military guys had sent over some army guards and they were keeping everybody away. But again, with the problems between Army versus Air Force, the Air Force declared they were in control of the town
and came to take over.
So that involved a firefight because the Army was not going to just walk away. We just heard all this wild gunfire out front. Very rapidly, the demonstrations had grown from dozens of people to many, many hundreds. They got very violent. They would take garbage cans, make a fire inside them, and then they would throw it over the fence. So the Air Force guards kept them away, but there was a lot of just random shootings. You know, like we'd be sitting in the consulate and suddenly like windows would start breaking. People were just shooting at the building. The bullet comes faster than the sound. Then you hear the report from the gun. We had to move down into the basement, so there's no windows. groups of people were breaking into offices, and they're taking out files and getting addresses of people, like who was with the secret police. They would take these tanks where the secret police lived, and they would open fire on the house and shoot everyone who came out. Matrinko had a lot of these files. When it was quiet, we could go upstairs, and we were actually burning a lot of files because there was some sensitive information there, who had gotten visas to the U.S. and why. At night, six of us there, nothing to do. Power would be going in and out. Bullets would be hitting the outside of the building. But we would try and count how many we heard in a minute. I think it was like 180. It was too nerve-wracking to sleep. Helpfully, he had a lot of cases of good scotch, good whiskey in the PX. So we were drinking that just to kind of numb ourselves. That would help us fall asleep. We'd sit around drinking scotch and listening to the Tom Lehrer records while all this stuff was going on outside. One night, it was a dramatically different demonstration. There was a lot more heavy equipment there, a lot more gunfire. The guards were actually firing back at the crowd. It turned into a pretty sizable gunfight, and we were starting to get pretty upset. Even Matrinko was getting a little concerned. He knew someone in the army. The barracks seemed like maybe a safe place to go. We were really scared, so we were saying, let's go to the base. We got to go to the base. We could have made a run for it. So Matrinko said, well, we can go there, but it's pretty dangerous because you don't want to be seen aligned with the army. We were almost ready to go, and suddenly we heard a huge explosion. It rattled the whole city. The depot that we were going to go to was blown up. Day five, we had an airplane lined up at the airport. When we went to leave the consulate, they'd pulled up an ambulance in front of the front gate. The plan was for us to get in the ambulance and lie down on the floor and drive to the airbase. You go out the front door of the consulate. We were trudging across a field to the front gate. There was some miscommunication between the guards, and they started firing on each other. We were in the middle. The bullets were whizzing over us. I think I even ran out of my shoes. I just remember being so flat. I don't think I've ever been flatter in my life. Matrinko had fairly prominent religious leaders put out orders, just let them be, don't bother with them. At this point, someone came to the consulate who didn't get the message to leave us alone. And they were pretty aggressive. They were not just looking for a little bit of money to go away. They were just going to kill us. A few of the guys took Matrinko away to his office in the consulate, and they were going to hang him. They weren't like idly threatening. Out of 10 steps to do it, they were at step 9. They had him up on a chair. They had the ropes around his neck. Matrinko spoke the local dialect as well as Persian. This came in handy because when they first came, they talked to him in Persian. But when they talked to each other, they talked in the local dialect that they were unaware that he understood every word they were saying. They were saying to each other, we'll kill the rest of the guys over in the other building, and we'll come back and kill Matrinko. How he wriggled out of it, I don't know. He had the rope around his neck. He was on a chair, ready to hang. But he came back about an hour later. He wasn't really shaken or upset, but he was like, okay, we got to get out of here. He went to the radio room. We all went with him. He's calling up on the radio to the embassy in Turkey to see if they could get someone over. They said they were going to send Marines over to meet us at the border. We were like ready to go 20 times. All these plans kept falling through. In the end, after all the frantic trying to get out of there, we got into an ambulance because it didn't look suspicious. Then we pulled up in front of the airport. He arranged to have a C-130 cargo plane from the Iranian Air Force. That was a fairly non-dramatic end to all the possibilities that could have happened. Eight of us sat in the back of this cavernous C-130 airplane, took off and flew down to Tehran. We had the clothes on our back, no money, no ID, no nothing. Matrinko had stayed to make sure we weren't abandoned. He was actually awarded 2 State Department medals for that. We went to the embassy in Tehran. We came straggling in, you know, unshaven, hair was all long and unkempt. We were pretty different from the rest of the Americans there who hadn't yet gotten out. Matrinko brings us in. Very matter of fact, I'll be around, but I got to get to work. We had no documents, so we went there and filled out forms. I got a handwritten passport with a Polaroid photograph. I think I was at the embassy 2 nights. No excitement, not the kind of excitement we were used to. They had chartered 747s from Pan Am. We got news that the planes were boarding people. We said goodbye to Matrinko. He was as cheerful as ever. Khomeini had fully taken over power by this point.
8 months later, Matrinko ended up one of the hostages.
We were bused to the airport. It was very nerve-wracking because there was no guarantee we were going to get out. They had a lot of checkpoints. And even in a situation like that, a handwritten passport was a little suspicious. And then once we got to the airport, people were just swarming to get to these airplanes. They had the stairs out. There was no jetways or anything like that. Walked up the stairs and I turned right and walked right into the first class cabin. So you're waiting and waiting and waiting. And it's nerve-wracking because, you know, you're not out yet. Finally, it takes off. And that was great, but you're still in Iran. It was really quiet, really subdued. No one said anything for 45 minutes. And then the pilot announced, you know, we were out of Iranian airspace. The plane just went crazy, cheering, screaming. At the time, they had a spiral staircase up the center in the front of the airplane with a piano bar. People were at it. Everyone was so happy to be out. That was a real relief. You know, that was 33 years ago, and now I'm a film and television set carpenter in Toronto.